What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It has been 415 days since October 7th, and the data we have says almost 45,000 Palestinians have been murdered, but we know that's an undercount. Here on Law and Disorder, we've spent most of the last Mondays inside of these horrific 415 days bringing you a full hour of Palestine coverage in an effort to counter and bury the mainstream media narrative of even so-called liberal stations that attempt to justify a moving genocide. We continue that coverage today. We begin with a conversation about the potential impact of a Trump presidency on Palestine. Joining us is Shane Kadidal, Senior Managing Attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, where he has worked on several significant cases arising in the wake of 9/11 and has been counsel in major cases challenging the material support statute. Good morning.
Morning, Kat. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thank you for a Monday. I want to start actually with, from your perch and the work that you do, and having gone through what happened in the wake of 9/11, some of those same ramifications we've seen recently when Donald Trump won the presidency, what went through your head in terms of your work in terms of Palestine?
Yeah, well, you know, look, a double-edged sword, right? I think, you know, the current administration really seems to have put no limitations whatsoever on military aid to Israel or on, you know, actions on the battlefield. And so, you know, to the extent that Trump is actually, you know, kind of temperamentally anti-interventionist, you know, part of me thinks, you know, maybe it's adhering to madman theory, but part of me thinks that we're more likely to see an end to the bloodshed with someone like him in power, just because the current status quo is so terrible. On the other hand, in terms of domestic repression, in terms of kind of putting down student protests, in terms of using terrorism criminal prosecutions to squelch Palestine activism in the U.S., that I expect to be much, much worse.
I'm going to tug on that thread. Trump has historically called folks who get into the streets for Palestine terrorists. What is the weight of domestic terrorists, that kind of designation?
Yeah, well,
how can that impact their life?
Sure. You know, the interesting thing about it is that that the terrorism sanctions are usually directed at folks outside of the United States. I mean, I think a key example is a recent designation about a month ago of a group called Sami Dune that was co-founded by an American and her Canadian Arab husband. The administration just designated Sami Dune as what's called a specially designated global terrorist. And once you designate a foreign entity that way, any form of interaction with the entity becomes the equivalent of sending guns and money to Al-Qaeda, right? Al-Qaeda is designated under the same scheme. So it's not just, you know, sending guns and money, which most people understand is prohibited, but it's also doing things like providing your own self as personnel or providing your personal services. So, for instance, me as a lawyer, I can't give legal counsel to someone who is a member of one of these organizations, even for free. I can't tell them how to comply with U.S. law because that would be providing services. And people always find this kind of shocking, but that intangible support can be considered providing material support to terrorism. But for activists, the real problem is that just doing coordinated political advocacy with people who are, say, members of Hamas or Hezbollah, that itself is a serious felony in the United States, potentially, you know, with 20-year sentences and million-dollar fines attached to it. That's the sort of problem that we're facing now when a group like Sami Dune, which had branches all over the U.S. and whose, you know, core officers did all sorts of advocacy work along with, you know, Palestine advocates in the U.S., when they get designated as a terrorist organization, suddenly doing advocacy, Palestine advocacy in coordination with them, even advocacy around a ceasefire or around, you know, charging or releasing indefinite detainees in Israeli custody, that kind of advocacy can potentially be a crime. And that poses a huge problem, especially with an administration that just has no respect for law and no sense of proportion or limits like the one that's coming into power soon.
I'm stuck on what you said about you couldn't even provide legal support to someone that has that kind of designation. Where are those people supposed to go or orgs supposed to go to get support?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the case you mentioned in my biography that went to the Supreme Court in 2010 involved folks who wanted to train members of the Kurdistan Workers Party and the Tamil Tigers in legal procedures for bringing claims to the United Nations and peace building and all sorts of things that you would think our government would encourage. And the question of providing legal counsel went all the way up to the Supreme Court and was a big feature of the argument. And what the Solicitor General at the time said for the government, Elena Kagan, who argued the case for the government before she was on the Supreme Court, she said, well, if you've got a constitutional right to habeas corpus like the guys at Guantanamo currently have, or if you're charged in a criminal case or something like that, if you have some right under the U.S. Constitution, we're not going to say that this prohibition on services goes that far. That still left a whole bunch of big problems, right? I mean, we've given legal advice to Julian Assange in the heyday of WikiLeaks' big disclosures, right, about extradition. That, you know, potentially could have been a crime if he were designated, right? When we first, you know, started representing the Guantanamo detainees in 2002, the government said they were all members of al-Qaeda, right? They had no evidence of it, but, you know, could they have charged us for providing material support to the organization? Who knows? Right. So now there are some regulations in place that Obama created in 2011, I think, that, you know, allow you to do a little bit more. But, you know, again, that's the kind of thing Trump could erase with the stroke of his pen. You know, but the bigger problem is really this coordinated advocacy notion, this notion that, you know, if you sign on to a statement with Samidun, who just got designated, that says, let's have a ceasefire, that can somehow be viewed as you giving a valuable service to Samidun, helping send out a message that they agree with, and therefore you've done the equivalent of sending guns or money to a terrorist organization.
Walk my listeners through the pathway that led to Samidun being jacketed as a terrorist organization.
No, sure. I mean, I think, you know, look, in terms of what Samidun did or didn't do, I think its designation is a little bit ludicrous. They've claimed that the founder, Khalid Barakat, the Canadian co-founder of the group, was somehow tied to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which has been on these terrorism designation lists for a long time. My understanding is that he broke away from that relationship a long, long time ago. So I think really the reason they got designated is that the administration wanted to designate somebody on the anniversary of October 7th. And that's why they picked him out. But there's a bigger, longer story here. You know, people maybe understand that if, you know, the U.S. is fighting in World War I against Kaiser Wilhelm's Germany, well, we have a trading with the enemy statute, and that allows the president to embargo not only sending money or guns to the government of Germany, but also to every German company and every German citizen, right? It's easy to tell where the lines are drawn there. President Clinton took that kind of notion in 1994 and tried to leverage the Palestinian groups to come to the bargaining table by saying, I am going to take that wartime embargo on Nazi Germany, say, and I'm going to extend that idea and create an embargo on an organization like the PLO or the PFLP or whoever, right? Hamas. The problem with that is that with Kaiser Wilhelm's Germany, you know who a German citizen is, you know what a German company is. With these organizations, it's always a little bit blurry, like who's a part of the organization such that you can't deal with them, and how much knowledge you have of somebody's association with an organization, right? So let's say, for instance, that Samidun was raising money for prisoners here in the US and Canada and was sending some of it to a person in Palestine to get it to prisoners in Israeli jails. And then it turns out that person, you know, unbeknownst to Samidun, had some relationship with Hamas, right? Well, the question of how close that relationship has to be, of how much Samidun had to know about it, these are questions that come up over and over and over again with journalists, with activists who do work in conflict zones, who do work, you know, in Palestine. And, they've just never been answered because the idea of taking national wartime embargoes and extending it to something ambiguous like an organization, there's a lot of questions that the government just has never cleared up. And frankly, they like the ambiguity because it keeps Americans away from these groups. The government admitted during the argument in that case that went to the Supreme Court. On the way up to the Supreme Court, they said, you know, Congress wanted to make these groups radioactive. They wanted to make Americans so scared of associating with them that they kept their distance. And this is, you know, the classic thing the government's not supposed to do under the First Amendment. They're not supposed to create a chilling effect that deprives Americans of their right to voice their opinion on contested political issues like whether there should be a ceasefire in Palestine.
What lessons should activists take from post 9/11 political climate? What did we learn? What should we do differently? What should we be careful of?
Well, you know, the government didn't try to push the boundaries of criminal prosecutions under these sort of authorities during the Bush administration. You know, I think they were content with the chilling effect that was created. You know, even after they won the case that we lost at the Supreme Court in 2010, we didn't see a big change in their prosecution patterns. I think, though, it's an open question whether we'll see that with the Trump folks, right? During Trump's first administration, you know, my observation of it as someone who litigates these cases was that they were far more incompetent in their attempts to do all the terrible things that the Bush people actually managed to pull off and coat in a nice veneer of kind of looking sort of legalistically proper, right? You know, the Bush people came up with all these innovations, like everybody at Guantanamo is an enemy combatant, right? And they managed to defend that stuff pretty competently. The Trump folks were a little bit more bumbling. So, you know, we'll see if the same thing happens here. But it is concerning that if the Trump people try to prosecute domestic activists under these authorities, that they've got a court system that is now much more heavily stacked in their favor, is much more conservative about these sort of things than it was under Obama or Bush. So yeah, I think activists should probably take the lesson that they should get in touch with lawyers if they're worried about any of this. And we at the Center for Constitutional Rights have made ourselves available. And today, after this call I'm doing, I think the eighth training that I've done in the last month to train up local lawyers all over the US to help advise people about it. So the advice is the same advice as if you get arrested, don't say anything until you talk to a lawyer.
Tie the kind of repression, suppression that we're talking about to what we've seen just in the last couple of months as college students have gone back to school and the chilling effect of punishments being handed down to both students and teachers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, we perceived the climate on campus as being very, you know, large donor driven, being driven by the financial pressures at the universities and also by the fact that, frankly, the administrative class within universities has grown so large in proportion to the professorial class that you have administrators who don't really understand the fundamental function of a university in a country's intellectual life, making decisions about free speech policies on campus. All that, I think, is going to continue to be true, although, you know, public opinion about the war in Gaza, I think, has probably swung much more in our favor than it was a year ago. That said, there are a lot of things that the new administration can do to pressure colleges to crack down even harder. And that is a really huge worry for our work going forward, that they'll start to, you know, tie federal funding, which is, you know, still an enormous pipeline of money to universities. As rich as some university endowments are, they're still totally dependent on federal money. And, you know, I worry that that the new administration will try to tie a lot of that, condition it on really repressive policies against protesters at schools, at campuses generally. So yeah, I expect to see worse than we've seen, remarkably.
How does repression and targeting of pro-Palestinian activists in the United States compare to other countries?
Hard for me to say. You know, I feel like at least in Western Europe, there is a long and venerable tradition of students creating large amounts of political mayhem. So I just think about all the 1968 mini revolutions on campuses in Europe. That said, I mean, you know, you've probably read a fair amount about kind of, you know, the sort of position of the German government about, you know, protesting the actions of the Israeli government. It's as if any criticism of Israel is you know, considered by default anti-Semitic. You know, frankly, that's roughly the position that, you know, kind of university campus administrators who've adhered to this idea that criticizing Israel, you know, harms the safety of Jewish students, you know, have also adopted. So, yeah, in some respects, the same. In other respects, I think, you know, probably much better.
I think you were alluding to elements of it in the earlier part of our conversation, but walk my listeners through the material support statute. What is it? Where did it come from? Mm-hmm. And what challenges to it exist, if any?
Sure. Yeah. So again, you know, when this country was founded, you know, if a country declared war on another country, it was open season on, you know, everybody who was a citizen of the other country, right? The second a war broke out, you could run out with your sailing ship and seize, you know, cargo ships of another country that you were, the country was at war with. It was chaos. And so a lot of this got normalized around World War I. Congress passed this statute called the Trading with the Enemy Act that again said, you know, we're going to give the president the power to embargo Kaiser Wilhelm's German government, but also every German corporation, every German citizen. And that power, you know, kind of continues in different forms to this day. But, you know, Bill Clinton was the one in 1994 who came up with the idea of, you know, let's create a, you know, anti-terrorism sanction program that allows me, the president, to embargo a non-state organization as if it were Kaiser Wilhelm's Germany, right? And, you know, again, the problem with that kind of scheme, which was turned into a statutory scheme, the Material Support Statute in 1996, and then after 9/11, President Bush, by a stroke of his pen, created another scheme, which is the biggest one that's used now. They all work the same way. You know, the government, the executive branch, usually the Treasury Department or State Department, gets to pick out an organization and say, that's a terrorist organization. And the second they do that, pretty much any kind of interaction by an American with that organization becomes a serious felony. So again, not just guns and money, but also giving them training or expert advice and assistance, right? So our Supreme Court plaintiffs wanted to teach the Kurdistan Workers Party, nonviolent peace building skills. And even that was considered to be aid to terrorism. The government said it explicitly. And so we brought that case up to the Supreme Court, and the court remarkably 6-3 said, yeah, that's okay. You know, this is what your guys, what your plaintiffs want to do is political speech. But we're going to say, because it's in relation to foreign organizations and it's in the terrorism space, that the government has a strong enough interest in criminalizing that speech and prohibiting it, that this doesn't violate the First Amendment, right? It's really the only kind of content-based restriction on speech, I think, that's been upheld in the modern era by a majority of the Supreme Court. So that brings us to the kind of current situation, right? Where, you know, you can be doing Palestinian advocacy, and if you're not certain that somebody on, you know, a 40-person conference call is, you know, maybe an agent of Hamas, you know, you may have to kind of get off the call or, you know, ask yourself serious questions about whether or not what you've done constitutes, quote unquote, coordinated advocacy, right? You know, again, there are a lot of ambiguities in the scheme in the wake of the Supreme Court decision, a lot of open questions that will, you know, maybe still get litigated. But the ambiguities work in the government's favor because they mean that you know, cautious people will you know, have to be extra cautious when they're doing advocacy that, you know, even relates to areas where the de facto government, you know, here Hamas in Gaza, is on a terrorist designation list.
These kinds of repressive activities are often challenged in court. Well, one of the things that Trump will do is appoint judges all over the place. How concerning is that to you from a legal perspective?
You know, definitely concerning. On the other hand, you know, one of the six justices who voted against us was John Paul Stevens, right? So I think, you know, he took, you know, a liberal lion of the court, right, before his retirement. And so, you know, I think, you know, this is an area, you know, where the court maybe is, you know, not as worried about, you know, Americans' free speech rights, because on the other end are foreign organizations that have been designated, right? So here, you know, again, Sami Dune was based in Vancouver. The co-founder, Khalid Barakat, who was also designated as a Canadian citizen. On the other hand, another co-founder is his wife, who's an American, right? And they had branches all over the U.S. So it's a way of taking these powers that the you know, even the more balanced Supreme Court in 2010 approved of, because they were powers that seemed directed at terrorists overseas, you know, but then you designate a group like Sami Dune that you know, does coordinated advocacy with all sorts of folks in the United States. And effectively, you've taken that power that was constrained to designating foreign organizations, and you've made it have an impact all over campuses and other NGOs inside the United States.
Talking about NGOs, HR 9495, the Stop Terror Financing and Tax Penalties on American Hostages Act, passed through Congress last week. And I got to say, even my pessimistic self, as we were tracking it, did not think that that was going to happen. Lots of fear and concern and alarm bells ringing, you know, throughout sort of the organizing ether. What is this bill? What does it do? Why are folks so concerned?
Sure. So the bill basically allows, you know, I mentioned that under the material support statute, the executive branch, the Treasury Department or whoever can just designate by fiat a group as a foreign terrorist organization. And once they're designated like Samidun, they have very little in the way of process, administrative process or judicial process in court to get off that terrorism list, right? Most of the evidence is secret and classified, and they don't get to see it in order to be able to respond to it. What this law does, this law aimed at stripping the nonprofit status, the 501c3 status of organizations that you know, are terrorist-supporting organizations, to use the label the law uses, right? If they, say, applied that to the Center for Constitutional Rights, where I work, that would make anybody's contributions to CCR no longer tax deductible, right? It would probably cut our funding by a third as a result. And again, the way the law is set up is just like it is for, you know, the terrorism sanctions. The Treasury Department can designate groups as terrorist-supporting organizations. And once they've done that, we would have very little in the way of process that allows us to fairly challenge the basis for that designation. So it's really almost like the government can arbitrarily designate domestic organizations, including ours, including the ACLU, including all the Samidun branches, you know, whatever else, as effectively terrorist organizations, and strip the tax deductibility of contributions, and therefore like choke off our financing that gets, you know, used to pay my salary and our expenses and litigating cases and all the rest of it. So, you know, this has been floating around for a little while. The problem was that a bunch of Democrats in the House were voting for it. Through a lot of advocacy, we managed to strip that number down to like just a little more than a dozen Democrats in the House. The problem is now, you know, the Democrats managed to lose both the House and Senate in the last election. So we expect this is not going to go through before Biden is out of office, but it probably will go through very easily once Trump is in office. And then how it's applied is going to depend on whether the courts find this offensive or not and stop it.
Shane Cadido, final words from my listeners. Anything I haven't asked you that you think fighters for justice should know about this current political climate?
It's a brave new world. And if folks are concerned about the legality of doing advocacy around this issue, don't just kind of, you know, throw your hands up and give up. Get in touch with lawyers in our network. There's a fantastic organization that CCR helped found called Palestine Legal that has a great intake kind of resources on their website. You can email them or fill out a form on their website, and they will connect you with people that we have been helping train to answer questions about this and hopefully give people reassurance that their activism is legal and that you should keep on doing it.
Great words to end on. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Kat. Take care.
You too. We've been speaking to Shane Cadidal, Senior Managing Attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, where he has worked on several significant cases arising in the wake of 9/11 and has been counsel in major cases challenging the material support statute. That takes us to 8:30 in the morning here on Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. It's Monday, which means we are spending the entire hour on Palestine coverage, and we are going to spend the second half of the show in a new, but what will now be a regular segment, where we'll be talking to our comrades either from the Arab Resource Organizing Center, or AROC, or Palestinian Youth Movement, about international headlines and local organizing. Today, we are joined by Samer Arabi, member of AROC, who also co-hosts the weekly Palestine Solidarity Announcements every Friday at 12 noon Pacific Standard Time. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks. Great to be here.
Really happy to have you. So I closed out with my last guest talking about the HR 9495, Stop Terror Financing and Tax Penalties on American Hostages Act. He gave a broad overview of what this could potentially mean for nonprofits. Generally wondering, from the position of AROC, what are your concerns? What are you bracing for? How are you preparing?
Yeah, as you can imagine, that has very much been on our radar for a while now. You know, even before this bill was introduced, we've been seeing, particularly among Republicans in the House, calls for AROC and its fiscal sponsor to be deregistered. You know, and we're not alone, right? But we are named out specifically, right? There are a number of Palestine organizations that are being called out and asked and being asked to have their nonprofit status revoked. So, we're taking that really seriously. We're watching it very closely. I think Shane's analysis was really on point. So there's not much more for me to say on that, other than maybe to note that it seems very likely that this will get through next year. You know, it's not super clear how the Senate is going to react to it. There's a sort of weird convergence with like hard right Republicans on this, where they're also worried that the law will be used to prosecute like January 6th type folks. So it's not 100% clear, but regardless of whether this specific law passes, it's abundantly clear for us that we are in an era of increased repression here. And you know, the Palestine organizing is of course just the tip of the iceberg here. You know, it's their easiest target, but it's definitely not the only intended target of this type of repressive legislation. You know, we've already seen and you know, folks may have already heard about this, that the Climate Justice Alliance, for example, is getting millions of dollars held in federal funding. So money that they were supposed to receive, they're no longer receiving, you know, ostensibly because they've taken a pro-Palestine position, but it's actually because the powers that be are also really interested in stopping the climate justice movement, right? And similarly, the racial justice movement. And so we'll see that expand over time if it isn't stopped here. So we really need to understand ourselves, I think, as the sort of first line of defense against this increased repression against our movements.
I didn't think about this with Shane, but as you were talking, Samir, I was thinking about like, okay, well, let's play this out, right? Let's say they come for AROC's money, then maybe the organizing step is to find an organization, not mine, of course, because that probably would not be helpful, but let's say a more benign organization, like to, you know, be a fiscal sponsor. But then I'm wondering about the ties to the material support statute, right? Or if
Yes.
on top of this bill, then they designate AROC as a terrorist organization, like they did Samidun.
Yeah, that material support stuff is so vague that it's really hard to know when and how it's going to be used. I think one of the things we need to start thinking about is, you know, alternative structures altogether, right? Like, how can we build out movement that isn't reliant on these 501c3 nonprofit structures? You know, that may be something we need to start thinking about next year. Or really, if we're smart, something we need to start thinking about this year so that we'll be ready in case something like that comes down the pipe.
I mean, something we like, real spit, something we've been should have been thinking about, right? Like,
Yes.
it's for those of us engaged in radical work, right? Trying to do that work or dance, you know, do that dance inside of a system that's part of why we do the work, right? Has long been a tension inside of even having a C3 status, yeah?
Yeah, question.
Our last guest, you know, I started with asking Shane from his perch at CCR what he thought when Trump became president of the United States and how that would impact, you know, Palestine and the genocide moving in Gaza. And his response was twofold, but he started by saying that a ceasefire is more likely under Trump, wondering what AROC thinks.
I don't know that AROC has a position on that, so I could maybe just speak for myself here. I think it's probably not wrong to the extent that I wouldn't say that it's likely. I feel like by the by, the probability of a ceasefire in Gaza has, you know, diminished to basically inconsequential margins. So we're talking about a really rare scenario here, but I do think that it's correct that Biden has such a personal commitment to Zionism, right? And such a willingness to forego his own political capital for the sake of maintaining the Zionist project that, you know, Trump, for all of his many faults, doesn't have, right? I think he's much more susceptible to that sort of public pressure, in the sense that he cares, right? That he cares too much because he's a narcissist about what people think about him and his reputation. And that is why I think he's trying pretty hard right now to get things sort of wrapped up a little bit. You know, one of the things that came out in the news last week was that Netanyahu is trying to wrap up the war in Lebanon as a quote gift to Trump, like an inauguration gift, you know, because Trump, I think, really wants to come in a situation where he doesn't have to deal with the conflict and the violence there. But the Lebanon stuff may in fact happen, but you know, given that the US is still pushing for Hamas to get kicked out of Qatar, for example, right? The negotiations have basically stopped at this point. They don't seem likely to start up again. The general's plan is in full effect in northern Gaza, where hundreds of thousands of people are being systematically cut off from aid and services and starved to death. You know, none of this points to an Israeli government that has any interest in a ceasefire, nor have they had an interest in a ceasefire, frankly. So, you know, the change in administration obviously changes our tactics, it changes our approach. There are different pressure points that will be brought to bear. But, you know, unless they're willing to cut off the weapons to Israel, Israel obviously has no interest in a ceasefire. So they have to be forced into that position. And that's going to take a little bit more backbone than I think either party is willing to show right now.
What Trump has said is he's going to deal with all of these unruly folks, the United States shutting down the streets, demanding a free Palestine. Your concerns about an uptick in suppression of protest?
Yeah, it's going to be a nightmare. I don't think we need to sugarcoat this. You know, our movements are in grave jeopardy. The situation is specifically designed to target us, delegitimize us. You know, we saw a sort of mini version of this on university campuses over the past, you know, like through the summer and coming out of it. Not many in the sense that that wasn't also horrific repression, but the first round, I think, of thinking through how do we cut this movement off at the legs? And, you know, they weren't successful there, but there's a whole broader set of tools that will be brought to bear against us. And you know, I don't want that to be a call to like fear and you know, like ceding ground. Quite the contrary. I think this is a really critical moment. You know, and Shane mentioned this too, I think, a little bit, that I think there is going to be an impulse for folks to feel like, oh, I can't do anything, or oh, I need to take a step back. But the way that we stay safe in an environment like that is actually the opposite, right? We need to step forward, that we need everyone as much as possible to be speaking as loudly as possible about these things. Because if they succeed in silencing the Palestine movement, then a series of other movements come after it. So, on the one hand, I think it's really important that we think about this as a moment to build as broad of a solidarity front as we can conceivably build. And the other is, you know, in the challenge comes opportunity, right? That as you mentioned, you know, there's all this work that we needed to have been doing for all of these years that we haven't done. Well, guess what? We have to do it now. You know, we're out of time. So it's going to be a reckoning for us to really get our house in order, you know, to think through all the pieces that we need to build out more resilience, to build out a stronger front. And this is going to be the time to do that. And I'm actually cautiously optimistic about our ability to do that as a movement.
I am too. I mean, one of the things that's inspiring is the solidarity that we've seen. And it's like sustained solidarity, right? Like 2014, when Palestinian Black solidarity around Black Lives Matter, we're seeing similar solidarity now, the connection of the dots between climate movement and the genocide moving in Gaza. I think that this is as terrifying of a moment as it is, it's also a politically powerful moment, should we sustain the resistance.
Yeah, I mean, no question. And, you know, in a lot of ways, the Palestine movement as it exists right now was built on the shoulders of the BLM protests from a few years back. And, you know, I think the left, in a lot of ways, is demonstrating more coherence and more solidarity than it has in a generation. And you know, there are a lot of strengths that we can build on here. And this is the irony of it, right? That the repression is coming precisely because of the strength, right? That we are now presenting a much more serious threat to the existing social and political order. And as a result of that, the repression is coming down harder. So, you know, that if we can continue on that trajectory, I think there's a lot that we can build in the coming years.
And of course, you know, one of the greatest sites that we've seen in the resistance has been on college campuses. Also, greatest sites of repression we saw with students coming back to school, teachers coming back to school, tenures being revoked, charges being pressed, kids being kicked out of school. From AROC's perch, what is the state of the campus organizing happening?
I mean, I think, you know, the extent to which campus organizing is still happening despite that repression, it speaks volumes to the resilience of this movement. It's remarkable, you know, given the extent to which students are risking everything, absolutely everything, to continue to show up, to continue to demonstrate. I think there was actually an article about this in the Times this morning, if I'm not mistaken, maybe yesterday, how like the new repressive systems against Palestine protesters on campuses are working. And the argument that they use to make that is that the number of protests has gone down to only 1,000, which, like, if there are 1,000 protests across college campuses right now, like, no, we're winning. Yeah. That's pretty great. And I think, you know, like the extent of that repression really speaks to the power of the movement, right? Because those campuses and those protests have done a really remarkable thing in terms of focusing people's attention on the material conditions that underpin the ongoing Israeli apartheid and occupation, right? The extent to which the military industrial complex and corporations are deeply complicit and in fact fueling, right? And accelerating this dispossession and genocide, and the ways in which these institutions are way more beholden, right, to arms manufacturers than they are to their own students. You know, there's no shortage of universities that actually get more money from defense contractors than they get from tuition. And it's just a wild state of affairs that these students are really bravely and really incredibly shedding light on. I don't think it's going to go anywhere anytime soon. I think that movement will continue to exist until we see much broader divestment in the same sort of way that we saw in South Africa. So, you know, they inspire us all. They continue to inspire us all. And in spite of the repression, they're still showing up, which is, you know, it gives me the energy to keep going.
So, Samir, you talked a little bit earlier about the potential ceasefire between Hezbollah and Israel. What, if anything, does that mean for Palestine, for Gaza?
A lot. You know, it's hard to know exactly what's happening in Lebanon right now. There are a lot of different moving pieces. Obviously, Hezbollah holds its cards pretty close to the chest. It's hard for us to get a really good, accurate read on what the current leadership is thinking and saying. But, you know, the original idea here was that front would remain open until there was a ceasefire in Gaza, right? And that's something that, you know, Nasrallah, before he was assassinated, said very clearly and regularly, that the rocket attacks won't stop until the situation in Gaza ends. You know, and there's a clear military and sort of broader strategic impetus here, right, which is to divide the Israeli forces to minimize their ability to carry out that genocide. That calculus may or may not be changing, right? And it may partly be changing because the ceasefire in Gaza seems to not be coming. And if it doesn't come, then that, I think, has to change the overall calculus on some level. So, you know, if you read the Western press, it seems like a ceasefire is coming very soon. You know, the U.S., and Israel and, you know, various Western European countries have all signed on to this agreement, this sort of like three-stage agreement that will result in first Hezbollah's forces going back north of the Litani River, you know, sort of in alignment with the Resolution 1701, which is supposed to be the basis of like the, you know, the end of hostilities from the 2006 war. Then Israeli forces retreat out of the country, and then they're supposed to recognize Lebanese sovereignty, right? That they won't cross into Lebanese airspace or have any troops on Lebanese land. And yeah, stage three is just like working out some territorial differences along the border. But it's not clear to me whether Hezbollah has agreed to this or not. You know, the big sticking point there has been the question about territorial sovereignty, where Israel continues to say, like, yeah, we'll withdraw our forces, but we reserve the right to come back whenever we want if we feel like the agreement isn't being honored, which, like, obviously is the opposite of respecting a country's territorial integrity. So whether Israel moves on that, whether there are some sort of like third-party guarantees or things, it's unclear. But, the ending of the Lebanese front, to the extent that if it does in fact close, obviously means that Israel can redirect a lot of its prodigious military capabilities back into Gaza, which is bad, right? Which is really, really bad. But I don't know. It's hard to say. There are a lot of balls in the air right now. These are things that we're analyzing sort of on a weekly basis at those Palestine Solidarity announcements. So I'd encourage folks to tune in to figure out what we know 4 days from now that we don't know today.
What a great segue. That was going to be my last question, but that means I can ask you something else. And I'm backtracking a little bit. I should have asked you this right after I asked you about the state of college protest, and that is Senate Bill 4127, the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. Walk my listeners through what that is and what it could mean.
Yeah, so a few things have happened here. Many months ago, the House passed a bill called the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, basically designed to codify into law a definition of anti-Semitism that's based on the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA, who basically say that any criticism of Israel is tantamount to anti-Semitism. And that's, you know, horrifically dangerous, right? Because the idea of criticizing a political entity, a sovereign state, is the same thing as anti-Semitism, like a, you know, like racism or hatred towards a particular people. That conflation obviously makes it much harder for our movements to operate, right? It's so absurd that even like hardline Zionist members of Congress actually in pretty large numbers voted against it. A thing that, you know, passed the House by a surprisingly slim margin, all things considered. You know, it still passed pretty easily, but I think something like 100 Democrats voted against it, including, you know, non-progressives at all. In the same vein, you know, the Senate, I think, had been sort of trying to slow roll it because on some level, there's also a concern about the extent to which that's going to cause sort of free speech, whatever court problems down the road. But it looks like this might be a thing that actually ends up moving through before the end of this political term. So while the current administration is in office, it may actually work all the way through. Not 100% clear on this yet, but this may be, you know, Chuck Schumer, who himself has actually spoken out against it, seems to be caving to pressure and will be calling a Senate vote on this sometime soon. So it's a weird moment of like a bill that Senate Democrats don't even want, but with AIPAC pressure and Biden administration pressure, it may go through nonetheless. So a really key moment, I think, to reach out to senators and tell them that this is not a thing that they should be voting for. And I think they're more flexible on this than we might think. You know, the Bernie Sanders joint resolutions of disapproval that failed last week, I think told us something and taught us something really valuable, which is that, you know, 19 Democratic senators voted to stop sending weapons to Israel. That's, you know, obviously a small number in the grand scheme of things, but a real tide change, you know, like a real shift in the way that the Democratic Party operates vis-a-vis Israel. The fact that constituents were able to move 19 senators, including, you know, really not left-aligned people at all, despite, you know, millions of dollars in AIPAC spending on this, despite the Biden administration calling each of those senators personally to get this passed, the fact that we moved that many, I think, really speaks to the idea that we actually could kill this bill. So I think there's a key moment here for advocacy to make sure that we can stop it from moving any further.
All right, Samir, I've got to leave it there for today. Looking forward to having you and other members of AROC on every other week for Palestine Post. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.